Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Swam Podcast. Swam Podcast.
Welcome, buds, to Swim episode number 11. The someone who isn't me on this one is Mr. Billy Gould of Faith No More. He was in London recently, and we got to speak about the upcoming reissue of the Faith No More debut album, We Care A Lot, which is coming out on Billy's label Cool Arrow on August 19th. And we spoke about the band's history, about the band's reformation, and nerded out about bass playing. Sorry about that. We also started to speak about some new material, and as if by magic, my phone started ringing, even though I was pretty convinced I'd turned it off, as if the universe was saying, shh, that's a secret. You mustn't talk about that yet. Anyway, so that's what happened. Also, if you hear there's like a weird kind of noise going on in a couple of places, that's because we were very kindly allowed to use the Sonos studios in London. Big up Sonos UK for letting me use the studios to record that. But whilst it was happening, there was actually a man outside the studio cleaning the floor with an electric cleaner thing. So that's what that noise is. Enjoy, Mr. Bill Gould. Check out. The reason you're here is because you're re-releasing the first album.
Right.
Which I'm really excited about. I actually dug my copy out last night.
Cool.
And it brought back a load of amazing memories for me. I remember getting it when I was like, I think I must have been like 14. I'm pretty sure I got Introduce Yourself first, and then kind of went back and was like, what else can I find? You know, I have really fond memories of that record, and it's the rawness of it.
Definitely. Well, I mean, really, we had 3 days to make a record. You know, we saved up we scrounged up as much cash as we could get from whatever direction we could get it in. We had just enough to get in there for 3 days. So it's raw because there really wasn't any time even for overdubs, hardly. It was mixed and everything. There's a certain thing where, I mean, you can just feel that it's rough. And also digital reverb was kind of a new discovery in the early 80s, yeah. You know. It wobbles like a real band, you know, like and kind of like kids too. It's kind of has a. I noticed that when I started listening to it again when we were running off these masters.
Yeah.
And I liked it in a good way. I was kind of afraid because it's like the old high school yearbook pictures, you know. Yeah. You don't want to look at. And
I think it holds up well.
Yeah, I do too. I was surprised by that actually. And I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, and like. Is it that you went in and did 5 tracks first? Is that right? You recorded 5 songs and then Mordam kind of. I mean, that was first release on Mordam as well, right?
Because
at that point it was just a it was a punk distro.
Yeah, exactly. They were just distro. They were doing like Alternative Tentacles and a couple other small labels. And okay, so what happened was, you know, we were this really strange band. We had a lot of friends in SF, and we were part of the scene, but it was this kind of music that really didn't fit in with any other band. We couldn't find a lot of bands to play with, and we did a demo. Matt Wallace had this 8-track studio that was... and we did a demo, and it's just like nobody was picking up on, nobody was grooving to it. And I kind of had this idea, like, the problem is it doesn't sound good enough. Like, there's nothing wrong with the music. It's just that sometimes people in the delivery, things can translate better and they're more open to hearing things. And it was like, I just had this theory, like, if we can record it a little bit better, maybe people would get it, you know. And what other choice did we have? We were just hitting walls anyway. And so we tried this thing where Matt's like, we can go book this, get this good rate in the studio. Let's just go there. We'll spend the night there. We'll sleep there and just make this thing. So we had like five songs and we just banged them out as fast as we could. And after that weekend,
what ones were they? Just out of interest.
The first side of the record, actually. Oh, okay. And so a friend of mine worked at Rough Trade in San Francisco, and I was just like, okay, now what do we do with this? And it's like, well, you know, you go to work, play this cassette on the sound system while people are shopping for records.
Yeah.
And maybe see if anybody says anything. That was like our marketing, you know, thing. And somebody, as a friend of ours, so I think she was working at Rough Trade too. Whatever happened, Ruth Schwartz was in there and she heard it. And somebody asked him who this band was playing, because they wanted to buy it. And he goes, oh, it's just my roommate's band. And Ruth, probably like within a week after we finished that mixing, called and said, I want to do a record label and I want you to be our first release. And we're like, oh my God, it actually worked.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that's why it worked, but well, that's what happened.
Yeah.
That's what happened. And so she, you know, got us the money to go and do side two.
Yeah. That's such a funny way of doing it as well.
Yeah, anyway. but it's cool also, because it was really just kind of like us, and it's like just completely gambling. I mean, I don't know when we could have ever paid that back, you know, the money that we got. I mean, it wasn't going to come back, but it was like we had to do it, you know?
Yeah. Now you've said that, now I kind of want to listen to the album in its entirety and see. I mean, is there a noticeable difference between the two sides? Because I hadn't even thought of that before.
Actually, there isn't. It was recorded in the same place, so we used a lot of the same mics in the same room. So
it wasn't that
different, actually. We had what we did with this record is, okay, one of the things that brought it out was when we signed this deal with Ruth Schwartz and Mordam. I mean, she gave us the most artist-friendly deal in the history of the music business. So after like 5 years, whatever, we just had masters. We owned the record. And it was the only one that we've had where we actually came back to us. And that's probably why it didn't come out for 20 years, is because we were preoccupied with touring and stuff and didn't really think about this old record that we did. And also it sounded pretty primitive to us. You know, back in the 80s, like converting from, you know, mastering to digital, it was a different sound, a little thinner and brighter, and digital technology was kind of new. And it wasn't until last year I was cleaning out my basement at my house.
Yeah.
And I found these reels of tape. And I was like, what are these? And they're the old master reels from the record.
That's so funny.
I didn't even know I had them. And so I called around and said, could I like to bake these, you know, and get them transferred to digital now with good converters and see. And I went to Fantasy Studios and just booked like a couple hours to do that. And it was like, they sounded really good.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like what they sounded like when we were mixing them back then. And I hadn't heard it sound like that in a long time. And I was like, just told the guys, like, this hasn't been out in 20 years. We own it. We should do this. And they were like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of really what made it all come together.
That's amazing. And to be in the position as well, you know, with you having Cool Arrow and also, I guess, with Mike having Ipecac as well. I mean, it's a great position to do that.
It is. It is. It's great. It's great. I mean, like they say, it's kind of like when you're in a band, it's kind of like you're serving food, you know? Music is like food. You have the restaurant, but, you know, we're kind of at the point now where we're growing the vegetables in the backyard too.
Yeah.
So it's completely from beginning to end where the delivery system is ours. And it's a lot more work in detail, which sucks for musicians, but it's great. It's a really great thing.
I think, but from an outside perspective, that's how the band's always been. I mean, regardless of who was putting out the records, it always felt like you were a band that was...
We were control freak oriented, for sure.
Yeah, okay. I was trying to think of a
And we always want more control, more control.
But it's, you know, and it's always, been, you know, when I was a kid and I first got those records, I mean, it was like nothing else I'd heard. You know, there were elements of post-punk in there, sure. And then there was, like, elements of other stuff that kind of, you know, there was bits of Sabbath and there were bits of this and bits of that. But everyone within the band seemed to be, like, a real... I mean, obviously, but, like, a real standout personality. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, with a lot of bands, that it always just seems like everyone focuses on, oh, here's the front man and here's the lead guitarist.
Right.
But it just felt like, you know, like...
Yeah, every personality was strong.
Yeah, really strong. Yeah. And I think that was that was the beautiful thing about the band, and also probably one of the things that made it a total ball.
I had an ulcer at 22, exactly. Yep.
But I mean, I guess that's the reason the band sounds the way it does.
Absolutely,
because
it
everybody, and it's funny because like you've known Roddy since you were kids,
10 years old. Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah,
and then and as I understand it, you became a bass player as to fill a role, essentially, right?
Sorry,
was it that when you were a kid and your friends started forming bands, people were playing instruments. Was that the way it was, or
it
were
was,
you always?
It was. Well, it's funny. That's what made me even first think about it. Was there was a group of us used to ride around on bicycles.
Yeah,
around in this area in LA, and Roddy was one of those kids. And I remember riding around. We basically go to the store and buy candy and hang out and eat candy together, you know.
Yeah.
And somebody was
Outlaws.
Taking drum lessons, and another guy had a guitar at his house. And so we just kind of decided we were going to be in a band. Roddy already knew how to play piano because his mom made him take piano lessons. Mm-hmm. And so everybody kind of had an instrument. I wanted to be in a band. And the only thing, I didn't even know what it was bass guitar, but I knew that we didn't have one. So I was like, okay, I'm going to learn how to play bass. And I went home and told my mom, I want to learn how to play bass. And I was like 12 years old. And the band never materialized ever, but I just started learning it and I just kept going.
Yeah. Wow. I'm grateful for that. Yeah. Like, for me, like, when I first started learning to play bass, the guys that I really looked up to were you.
Oh, cool.
Like David Sims from Jesus Lizard.
Right, right.
And Joe Lally from Fugazi. And, right. And even though you all have very much your own styles, there was something that kind of tied it all together for me, because it was very propulsive and, yeah. And this...
It's active, right?
Yeah, and the repetition is, you know?
Right.
You were all bass players that were bass players.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
I would say that's true.
Because it wasn't, they were all, you know, you were all playing parts that were just vital to the song that propelled it. But also, it wasn't just like, oh, I'm the guy that plays the guitar lines,
right.
and just fills in the weight at the back. It just felt like, when did you start developing that as a style? Well, how did that come about?
I mean, I started learning how to play with fingers, really. So it wasn't so attacky. Until I met Borden when I was 18, because the way he plays is attacky. There's no other way to play with him or make it really work. But, I mean, I would say like those other bass players you mentioned, and I could be wrong, but if I could make a guess, they probably learned the way I did, and that was, you know, I learned how to play some songs off records, but basically what I did first thing was I joined a band and started writing music with other people. Right away, before
Straight
I even
away.
Really knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
So I would just kind of listen to where does this feel good or does this not feel good? Hmm. And I didn't really have any rules to follow. And a lot of people I've met for the bass guitar, you know, are basically told, this is your role. You want to fill in between the drums and the guitar. So you want to fill in the holes and be as invisible as possible.
Yeah.
Right? I'm the songwriter and stop stepping on my stuff. And I didn't have that. I just had what can I do with this? And I don't want to walk on the guy, but what can I do that's kind of fun for me? And so there weren't a lot of rules, and that helped a lot.
And what were the bands when you first started playing? Because I guess you're saying about playing with Mike and his style of drumming is so distinctive.
Absolutely.
I guess that were you kind of going down that road already though? Before you started playing with him?
Let me think about that. So I'm 53 years old now, and I started playing when I was 12, so I've been through a couple different approaches.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But when I first learned, you know, 12 to 13 to 14 to 15, all the cool music to play bass was what my friends' big brothers were listening to, and that would be Yes, Genesis, King Crimson, stuff like that.
And so quite proggy.
Very proggy.
And a lot going
technical,
on.
Technical.
Yeah.
But also stuff that I would... My 12-year-old self would never ever be able to play in a million years.
Yeah.
So also kind of like not really that accessible, you know. I remember like I was in a band with our original singer, Chuck Mosley.
Hmm.
He was a keyboard player originally.
Okay.
And actually the guy who works it on Resonance, Art Terry, he's a DJ here in London. And a guy named Mark Stewart, Stu, He's known as Stu. Anyway, these are all different people that all ended up being doing other things with music. But anyway, when I was like 12, 13, 14, I played with them, and I remember that we were all kind of like prog guys, and that somebody brought the Sex Pistols record over the house, and it's like, I want to hear it. And
yeah.
It was like, that's terrible, that's the worst. And like, I think like threw the record across the room, you know. And then, okay, can you put that on again? And it was like, you know, I don't want to admit to anybody, but I kind of like this, you know. And I think it took like 2 days where I was like, okay, I'm totally into this. And
yeah.
This is totally music that I can play. Mm. And this is totally music where my teenage self actually really enjoyed, because it's like not passive music, and it took the music from being on a pedestal, and it really made it like kind of me, my personality.
Yeah.
So I would say musically that was really the thing. And it's okay, I met Borden and he has a totally different style, but I would say I took my mentality and that was already there, and I kind of just fit it with style, and I didn't worry about the technical part as much as the feeling part. And actually, I mean, if I was playing in another band, I probably wouldn't do that well in a lot of bands. I do what I do. Hmm. I learned how to do what I do. But I don't stack up. Other people do what they do much better than I could ever do. But I found my voice and my place, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's what makes the band so special, as I said.
I suppose so, yeah.
That everybody...
It worked for me.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm really glad I didn't get stuck in the route where I had to, you know, learn the rules, because I probably would have been very mediocre. Yeah.
That's how I ended up. But I look back on these things now, and you know, obviously, Sol Invictus is out, and it got amazing praise, because rightly so. It's a brilliant record.
Thank you.
But it did feel like, you know, I think as a fan, you were definitely one of those bands that everybody wanted to come back. But I understood that the situation was, you know, you'd been through these lineup changes, and then when the real thing came out, it just felt like suddenly things were really taking off. And was it then the touring grind that kind of...
I mean, we had it anyway, really, because back in the first record, and then Introduce Yourself, I mean, we did some pretty rough tours without any money, and we kind of already were between ourselves a little bit fried. And we were young. We didn't really know how to communicate well with each other. We weren't very respectful, that's for sure. And there was a lot of alcohol involved.
Yeah.
But by the time we did the real thing and we did all the touring, that part of it continued on. We just were having very little time for ourselves. And okay, so we're getting in our later 20s, and we kind of wanted to have a little bit personal lives, and we didn't. And yeah, that was a real pivotal point where we kind of all maxed out, I think, psychologically.
Yeah. But then Great Art came out of that, ever, you know.
It did.
Angel Dust is without a doubt one of the finest. Well, I don't want to be that guy, but I think it's, for me personally,
it's definitely well respected by a lot of people. Yeah.
I'm one of those people.
Cool.
It's
weird. I mean, our thing, I don't know if I can compare to any other band, because our, like, Angel Dust was just such a gut reaction. Like, if we're going to keep our sanity, we have to do something like this, you know? And really, we were encouraged in every way not to do what we did. And when we did it, it really didn't go over that well. And it was kind of like we kind of had this need to make this record, and we didn't get much positive feedback at all. So it was like we trusted our gut, and it was wrong, you know? But what else could we do? Okay, in retrospect, it wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, when you're saying that this is as influential as it was, okay, it wasn't. And I understand that. But it was very strange for us, because we knew we were doing the right thing, but we didn't ever get any validation for it, really. Not that much.
Do you feel like... but when you were doing that record, did it feel like this is a total fuck you to a lot of what was going on around the band, or did you feel like this is, I don't know, you don't really take those things into consideration, do you? Is this going to be a commercial? You can't think like
if you're making
art, because then you lose everything.
It was more like I look at it from, you know, to be subjective, like, what would excite me to do right now?
Yeah.
And what am I sick of? And you know, with the real thing, part of the thing that came with this success was we were just kind of thought of, this is new style of mixing funk with metal music, you know?
Yeah.
And these guys are doing this thing. And so, you know, think about it. You're on tour and, you know, some kid wants to give you a demo tape and it's some band with a funky bass line, you know, with a metal guitar. And
I was probably one of those guys. I'll apologize now.
But I got a lot of that. And I was just like, this is the last thing I want to do. You know, this is not me, you know?
Yeah.
And,
well, that's the funny thing, because it did seem like at that time there was all of a sudden, here's this new genre of music, and we can talk about what that then became later on. But I mean, it just seemed like you were never part of that. It's like occasionally you'd have like a slap part.
Right.
And people were like, oh, okay, slap bass. That's right. So they're part of this thing.
Yeah.
And I remember when like all the bullshit about you guys and the Chili Peppers when that came out, when Patton first joined, and was like, are you fucking kidding me?
I didn't. That never made sense to me either.
Like,
that's just strange.
Him saying, yeah, well, yeah. I mean,
as things happen, but
time has proven.
Yeah, but it's like you're playing cards, you know, and you're like, somebody gives you, this is your card, this is who you are. And you're like, I don't want that card. Can I have another card, please?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, why don't you want your card? We're giving you a card, and, you know, take the card that you're given. It's like, no, I don't want that card. That's not me. And it was a little bit of that. And I'm glad we fought against that. We definitely wouldn't have made more records if we would have gone that route, because, you know, there were other frustrations and stuff too.
Yeah.
So and I think really Angel Dust was the beginning for me of like a real productive period of making cool stuff and really just going like, because after that, we did that. We were still alive. We were still intact. It's like, well, okay, so we did something totally stupid and we came out of it okay, so we can do whatever the hell we want.
Yeah.
And actually, the more further we would take it, almost encouraged us, because it's like, everything's going to be okay. You know?
Yeah.
Where when we were making Angel Dust, everybody's like, why are you killing your career? You know?
That's crazy looking back at it now in hindsight, isn't it? Because of the reach and the influence of that album in particular. Well, the band,
yeah,
its entire career, but for some reason that always just seems to be like that pivotal
that is
moment
one of those people... things. Yeah, yeah.
Is that a frustrating thing? Because I mean, you've made a bunch of really amazing albums, but it does seem in a way like that one always seems to get,
you know, it should bother me, but it doesn't.
Yeah, I guess not.
No, because that was one we really did stick our neck out on, so I actually really happy, but I haven't heard that record in, you know, 25 years.
It holds
and
up
I probably
really
won't.
Well.
Yeah, cool.
It really does. And it's crazy because there's so many bands now, not like younger bands, because it seems like a lot of kids that are coming through now that are playing in bands and that are having success, they don't have their list of influences stops like two generations early. I don't mean that like in generations as in age, but do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like the influence of Faith No More on a bunch of bands, it's like Deftones, for example, and to a degree Slipknot as well, like Corey will
always been real supportive of us.
But kids now that are coming through in bands will go, oh yeah, like our influences are Deftones and Slipknot, and it's like, well, you're aware of Faith No More, you're aware of Killing Joke, you're aware of PIL, and I think, I don't know, it just kind of,
you know,
it kind of bums me out a little bit.
I think it's always been that way. I remember I grew up in LA in Hollywood, and I moved up to San Francisco, which is a totally different scene. But I remember asking my friend, like, down in, it's like in the 80s, like, what's it like in LA? What's the music like in LA? And like, well, it used to be like these punk bands that I hated, didn't know who the Sex Pistols or the Damned were, you know, were punk bands. And now there's bands in LA who don't know who Black Flag or the Adolescents are, you know, so they don't even know who those bands are.
Yeah.
And it was like, I mean, that seems similar to kind of maybe now. It's just kids are very short-sighted. What do they discover is their immediate thing first. I don't know.
Yeah. But, I mean, do you ever sit... I guess it's a weird thing to ask, but do you ever think about the influence that it's had? Because
I think
you know, it changed the face of heavy music without a doubt.
Well, it's really cool to hear, but I would go crazy if I thought about things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd still like to live in 2016 and think I have more things to offer. You know?
Yeah, no, I'm
but yeah, but,
well,
but it's an amazing thing. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Like last night at the Metal Hammer Awards, like, it made me realize, like, people I don't know who know who I am and respect, talk to me with respect. That's a great thing.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing, definitely. You know, after this huge period when the band had broken up, everybody was doing other stuff. You know, you were running the label and mm-hmm. playing in other bands, and mm-hmm. Patton just seemed to be
doing everything else. That and more, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Mike was played in Ozzy's band and stuff. So everyone was busy, but it was like, at what point did it feel like that now's the time to kind of... Do you think that it was just a case of... Like, yeah, what was the reasoning, and also how did that come about, those sort of first steps?
I wasn't around when I think the thing really started. That's when Roddy got married and everybody went to his wedding, and I was in Europe, so I didn't go to that. And they all got together and had a great time and like kind of all hanging out for the first time since we'd split up.
Yeah,
I mean, we'd all seen each other individually, but not all together. And I think that everybody got a little sentimental.
Yeah,
I wasn't there, so I didn't have that.
Yeah,
and then I heard they were all going to get together for lunch again, and I was very kind of. I was actually, oddly enough, the most skeptical and suspicious in a way. It took me a while to kind of, you're like, really, what's this all about? You know, but I hadn't hung out with them, and actually, when I did meet them for lunch, we had a great time.
Yeah,
and it was kind of one of those things, like, even if I wanted to be guarded, I couldn't, because I was happy to see them. It was kind of cool to all be at the same spot.
Yeah,
we all do have these experiences that only we know about, that we can't share with other people because they weren't there, and it's part of who we are as people. Yeah. Like it or not, we're the only ones that know about them, and it's something cool about that.
Yeah, it's a very magical thing.
It is. It is. You know,
I find that, like, you know, I'll get back together with guys I haven't seen, like, you know, like the guys in A, and we don't see each other that often now. But when we do, it's like no time has passed at all, and we could have not seen each other for
years. It's really interesting, isn't it? How that works?
Yeah, it's kind of strange.
Yeah.
But so then starting up to play shows is one thing. That's a big step.
Right.
But it's fun. There's money involved.
Right.
Great.
Right.
But then, obviously, then I remember at the time when you first started playing those shows, everybody's like, on the internet, when's the record? And it almost seems like an inevitability, but at the same time, I thought it was very cool that it was very much just like, no, we're just going.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We play shows because we like to play.
I mean, that was frustrating for me. I wanted to make music.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want
to. I can imagine.
It takes a lot of effort. I mean, it sounds all great. You know, all of a sudden people want to see you play. They're going to give you some money, play these big shows. And it seems like it's very simple. That's all you got to do is show up and play. But actually, for me, it's a whole focus thing. And it's like, well, I don't want to put so much of my energy into it unless there's a creative part to it, too.
Yeah.
You know, and that took a while, for everybody to get comfortable enough to want to go there, because that's also a whole other commitment.
I mean,
when you're making a record. And that's why we didn't tell anybody we were doing it. It was because it's like, once people know you're doing this, then everybody wants to stick their nose in, wanting to know when it's done. Is it out yet? How come it's taking longer? What's the deadline? It's like, we don't want any deadlines. We don't want any stuff. Let's just not tell anybody, you know, until it's ready to go.
Yeah. And how did it all start then, that first?
We're so stupid. I mean, as a group, we have a great... We have a lot of great things about us, you know. We're very headstrong and in a good way when we sync together. But we have this other thing where there's like an elephant in the room. Nobody will bring it up and nobody will talk about it.
Yeah.
They just won't. And it doesn't mean that they don't want to. It's just nobody wants to be the guy to say it first.
Right, yeah.
I don't know.
In case other people are like, don't want to know.
It's like family dynamics. Like Uncle Charlie's a drunk, but nobody wants to actually come out and say it, you know?
Yeah.
And we had that. We had that probably for about a year of doing shows. And it's like, I don't, you know, you don't want to be the guy who brings up something unpleasant because you're having such a great time, but you got to bring it up.
Yeah. Why did you go and spoil it by saying that? Yeah, yeah.
One day I just like was at our rehearsal space and I just told Borden, like, he was just sitting around and like, do you want to just record some stuff, you know? I mean, I got my mics here, you know? Just make some noise, you know. And don't you ever want to do it? And he's like, yeah, totally. You know, it was so easy just to ask him, you know. Mm. And we just recorded some stuff within a day. I think we did Superhero was like that first day. It came so quickly. And then it came to a point, it's like, Roddy, you know, so this is kind of what we did, you know. And he's like, yeah, sure, okay. And I was like, okay, that's great. Now, okay, we've got to talk to Mike P about this, like,
yeah,
what's he gonna do, you know?
Yeah. Like,
and I just said, hey man, like, we're doing some stuff, you know, I don't know if you know, just hear it, whatever, take it for what it's worth. And he's like, oh, do you want me to sing on this? And it's like, well,
we were gonna call Chuck again.
Yeah, no, that would be cool. But he was like, he's like, oh, this is really great, what could I be involved? Yeah. Nobody is like, everybody's so passive. You know, when you think about us, like, I mean, the way we are with other people, we're so headstrong, like kind of overconfident almost. Mm. But like with each other, it's like everybody's like all not wanting to be the guy to, you know, to say, I want to do this, you know?
Yeah.
It's very funny. We're really strange like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's surprising, though.
It is surprising. It is surprising. But that's kind of how it is. And so, but then, I mean, the cool thing was, it's like, well, look, nobody has to know, you know? Like, let's just do something and see what happens, you know? Mm. And so, we were in rehearsal space. We just started recording and, like, but then it's like, don't tell anybody. We don't need this bullshit, you know? We don't even know what label's going to put it out. We don't know anything. We're just kind of doing something to see what kind of happens. And it was all going really good. And we're like, this is pretty cool. And it's like, you know.
And this was all in the rehearsal space, yeah? Is that right?
Yeah, in rehearsal space, exactly. And then it's funny because then after, you know, we did this for like 6 months, 8 months, and you know, you go out, and the way, at least in the States, people are like always up to me, like, what are you doing now? You know, what are you doing? And they look at this concerned look on their face, you know, where like I'm supposed to be telling them how productive I am, you know, and I'm just like, you know, just not telling them I'm working on a record, you know, I don't want to tell anybody. And everybody's kind of like, you're playing with these guys, what are you doing? And we just didn't tell anybody. But it was great because when we kind of said we were going to make the record, it was about 85% done, and we knew we knew we were there, and we were cool with it, and it's like, and it was great. It was perfect.
And how did you settle on when you were releasing it the way you did with the imprint? Because I can imagine that as soon as people are aware that there's a record coming, there must have been a bunch of people. Or is that just me being naive? Was there a bunch of people offering to put it out?
There was. Okay. It's a really weird period of time we live in now, you know, where we're supposedly this iconic band that
you are,
hasn't put out a record in for 18 years, you know, and so it's like, well, so we're talking amongst each other. Nobody knows we're making this record. It's like, this, some people say, if you did something now, it would be huge, you know, and other people are like, you know, why don't you just put something out, you know, it doesn't matter anymore, you know, this is the digital revolution, and just, you know, put it out for free, you know, like, so, you know, there's all these different ways you can go with it, and Mike was like, you know, we could totally do this, and I could totally do this, and it's like, yeah, but, you know, I'd like to know just what it's like out there, you know, like, let's just throw our little cast our net out there and just see, you know, how people would want to put out our record and what would happen. And everything we got back, we got interest, but it was like, oh, that kind of sucks though, like oh but then we'd have to do that, and oh that doesn't sound like fun, you know. And Mike's like, you guys, why don't we just do it ourselves? And he's like, yeah, you're totally right. But we kind of had to go full circle and see what our options were. That was definitely the best option.
Yeah, I think so as well. And you know, as we said at the start, like, the band is so self-contained, and, you know, why not?
Yeah.
But I was curious, because I would imagine that there would have been a few people, but the way deals are set up now, it's horrendous.
It's a weird world. It's a really weird world, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say. I'm just talking about the cranky old man. I'm gonna stop right now.
That's fine. I'm that way as well.
Yeah.
But I presume that there's every chance that there would be more of that. Is that right?
There should be.
Oh my God! What a dick. Sorry. That's unbelievable. Well, I'd like to hear more. That's for sure. Especially, you know, when I first approached the record, like. I remember I said to you when we did an interview for Radio 1, I was like, I was almost I was kind of nervous listening to it the first time.
Right.
Just because, I don't know, it's one of those things.
We heard that a lot from people.
Yeah, because you feel like you've invested so much.
It's part of your life.
Yeah.
And you don't want to see it go bad because, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people told us that. And it's funny because it's like, a lot of people cared so much about the band, but then they start telling me how worried they were and they don't want to hear it. Like, I know people that bought the record when it came out but couldn't have the courage to put it on for like a week and it was like, God, you know, I'm really glad that we're cool with what we did, because like, you'd be scaring the shit out of me with this,
you know?
Failure is this big F staring me in the eyes, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's great that people like are invested in the band like that, but at the same time, being a member of the band, it's like, damn, you know, that they're, what are you scared of? Like, let me hold your hand. Everything's gonna be okay. You know?
Yeah, I know.
It's a strange psychological condition, you know. But it's also really cool because it means, you know, people are really connecting it genuinely with the music. And they care. That's fucking great. I mean,
as a guy in
a band, if somebody has that reaction, that's it. You connected.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing what happens with it. But going back to the reissue.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting because in my head, like, you've just blown my mind when you said that you found the tapes in your basement.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm aware of how things work, and I know that people, you know, have to wait a certain period of time before they get the rights back on their record.
Right.
And if, you know, if at all, well, I mean, they do, but it's a long time. And I kind of thought it was one of those deals. I thought that, you know, I mean, it's what, 31 years. Is
that
right?
1985, yeah. 31 years, yeah.
Wow. So I figured it was one of those that you'd got the rights back and you were like, well, we can do this with it and we can make it sound, as you said, more how with the initial intention, like a bit thicker, a bit more warmth. And,
right.
But yeah, it wasn't.
We got
that.
The rights back in 1992.
Yeah. Yeah. With this being one of those things now where there's a lot happening, you know, obviously with like Page just did all the Zeppelin ones.
Right.
I was speaking to him about that and he was that, you know, they were finding tapes of things because he was meticulous. He kept tracks of things and they were going to studios and finding out that things had been stolen, like,
really?
Oh yeah.
I bet. Why?
And bootlegged and
yeah.
whatnot. So I was curious as to what there would be as far as the extras, so that you've got some demos on there, you've got like the remastered stuff,
right? Well, the demos are basically the demos that we did in the A-Track studio that didn't fly with people, but you know they don't sound that much different. But you can just kind of hear how we did the songs when we really had like, I mean, we did those and mixed them in 2 hours or something, right? They were very quick. It's just kind of interesting to hear, you know.
Yeah.
And those were taken off of reels as well. I had those reels. And then, okay, so the 2016 mixes, what they're called, we have three songs. And I found another reel in my basement, and it was a 2-inch tape. It was multi-track. It was only for three songs.
So I
transferred those at the same time, and I said, hey, Matt, let's do a little experiment. If you could mix these songs again, because I know he there's certain things about those mixes that probably bothered him for 31 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, here you go. Do what you're going to do. I'm not even going to get in on it. You just do what you're gonna do and give us what you're gonna give us, and it'd just be a cool experiment. And that's
and
what we did.
And you just let him have free reign.
Just let him do it. Just let him do it. That's it.
That's very cool.
So it's cool. It's funny in what he did differently, and also it's kind of funny in how it doesn't sound that much different in a way too. It was just a cool experiment, and it's kind of like, what if you could do what you did in 1985 again in 2016? What would you do different? And that this is kind of what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering if there would be any, like, I mean, there's recordings out there of you guys playing those songs now, or a couple of them anyway.
Right.
But,
re-record the songs, you mean?
Yeah, I don't know.
It wouldn't feel the same.
No.
I don't think so.
It would be interesting to just hear the difference, but that's just me as a nerd, I think.
Well, we have these one other thing that our drummer got. He's the guy, he's the archivist in the group. Yeah. I don't know why he didn't end up with these master tapes and why I did.
Yeah.
But that's how it happened. But he has like a lot of old videos and board recordings from us over the years. And he has this one video that nobody's ever seen that somebody gave him a copy, but this guy has like the only copy, and it's when we played a live show around the release of this record. And it's cool to see us playing the songs off the first record live, and it's from that era. And the sound is a little different, and you can see us playing. It's pretty primitive, but it's cool. And hopefully we're going to be able to release that with this record out, you know, and get it out somehow.
Yeah.
Because it sounds pretty good. We used two of the songs on that recording on this record as well, two live tracks, okay. And they're taken from this video. But it looks and sounds really good.
Oh, cool. I'd like to see that. I don't know if I saw you play around that.
With Chuck?
Yeah. Because I was thinking about this the other day, and then I started thinking, I'm sure I saw him play with Bad Brains, and then I was like, have I made this up?
No, he did.
They did a show at the Marquee. But, I couldn't have done.
You know, it's cool for me.
I definitely didn't think about it. Did you tour over here with him around that?
Chuck, we did two tours with
him.
We did two tours, yeah.
When that would have been, what, like 86, 87?
86, 87, yep.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, the reason we're touring, we toured at all, is because here it actually connected. It didn't connect in the States at all. First interview we ever did was with Sounds, and they flew out to Atlanta to interview us, and we couldn't believe anybody even wanted to talk to us. I mean, it really worked here first more than anywhere.
Yeah, it seemed that way. I mean, it's always seemed like it was like a real, like here and Germany and South America, it was always really good as well, right? It's kind of weird.
It is weird.
Why did you put that down to? Do you think it was just because the band was so, I was going to say progressive, but I don't mean that in a like a
right,
that way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was so much its own thing and wasn't prepared to sit in amongst anything else.
I really have no idea. It didn't fit in with everything. I'm surprised. Actually, the audience that kind of first really gravitated towards us was a heavy metal audience. And that's cool. But I never thought I was in a heavy metal band before. but, you know, I don't care.
Yeah.
Do you know? That's great. And there's a lot of metal music I like. So that's all good with me. But it was just kind of interesting how, like, that's kind of the people that kind of really, the rock crowd really grabbed it first. Yeah. We have this kind of rhythmic, kind of almost dancey music.
Yeah.
And I said, why do these guys like that? But I'm not going to, you know, ask why. And
take what I can get.
Exactly.
How did you see the band when you first started? Because I think the post-punk feel was definitely there, and it just felt like there was it felt like that there was, this is probably me getting it wrong, but it felt like there was like a lot of British bands there, like post-punk and like, you know, like I said, and Susie and, you know, a little bit of goth even, which is kind of weird. Well, but it just, I don't know.
When we first started, I played with Mike Borden. When I first met him, I mean, the band, the music we were playing was kind of post-punk, actually. Okay. Like Theater of Hate, kind of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And what kind of really was a break for us was, I mean, we're California boys, so I really thought music, like with post-punk, was really moving in a very positive direction. It was going into new places, and that part was really interesting. It's like bands like This Heat, you know, total forward-thinking stuff. But, you know, I surfed, and it was like this other energy that so it wasn't me playing just that kind of music with those rules wasn't me. It wasn't who I was. And we kind of had some tensions with some people in the group that we parted ways with who kind of wanted to go that way. And we're just like, we have to be who we are. We have to be ourselves. And that's kind of where, you know, Chuck kind of jumped in, and Jim actually kind of jumped in, where it was like, you know, we don't really know who we are. We know what we like.
Yeah.
We're just kind of a bunch of peckerheads, and we're just going to try to be ourselves, I guess. Yeah. But I think that maybe there's something familiar with people here, where there's this post-punk kind of melodic structure, but there's this also kind of exotic California thing maybe we had.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah.
But I mean, we skateboarded, and I don't think like Yeah. Sisters of Mercy skated, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
I'm just making a guess. I really don't know.
Yeah. Are you going to do any shows in support of this, do you think?
And I'm going to try to.
That's another thing entirely again, because if it was... I mean, you don't play... How many of those songs do you play? You played...
Good question. Worm.
Like, yeah.
Sometimes we do Pills for Breakfast.
Yeah.
Sometimes we do Good Care a lot, obviously.
Yeah.
Sometimes we do Why Do You Bother? Actually, quite a few of them.
Yeah.
We play probably almost half of them.
Okay. Yeah, then it doesn't... Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it like that.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, yeah. It's so funny. There's so many... This group, when you go 30 years, there's so many different eras you kind of have yourself.
Yeah.
We're even like a mix of different eras. I mean, because Patton does a lot of Chuck songs, but it actually feels pretty natural. So
yeah.
There's like As the Worm Turns with Mike P, and there's the original one, and it's almost like two different bands.
Hmm.
But it's the same people for the most part. And I don't know.
Well, when you did those shows and Chuck came out, how was that?
I was weird. Like, the weirdest part was the sound check, because hearing his voice on the monitors was a little strange. It's like,
yeah.
Creepy. It was creepy. It was like a dead, like a person that came back from the dead, you know? I have so many bad memories of playing shitty clubs with hearing that voice on my monitor. but great, you know? And you know, when it goes to a point like that, you can't do any wrong. I know Chuck forgot, like, lost a lot of words to the songs and stuff, but it really didn't matter, you know? It was kind of the spirit of the thing, and the spirit was the thing. And also, he kind of brings his energy into the group that it's a different group. It's really strange to say with everybody else is exactly the same, but Jim wasn't there, but still, you know, he came out as an encore where we just did a whole set as Faith No More 2016 and Chuck came out and did like three songs, and it was like my wife used to say, like, wow, you guys were a totally different band. This music is totally different with him, you know? And it's true. So it's cool. You look at yourself a little differently. In a way, you kind of see that this person who you think you are actually has more dimension than you thought you did. So for discovery process, it's really cool.
Yeah.
To see that, wow, there's another side of me that I forgot about, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
I mean, that's the thing about a band, isn't it? It is really the sum of its parts and the chemistry and how those things all interact with each other. It sounds crazy, but I mean, especially when, you know, you've had a few guitarists.
We have, absolutely.
And yet,
Jim
was
funny. Like our sixth or seventh, actually. Yeah, we already had six or seven before Jim even joined the band. Yeah,
and for you to say as well about how you were embraced by like the metal community. I mean, that's the one thing that you would think would be this is the in, which I guess it was to a certain degree for a lot of people, because Jim's playing was very
that, and he had his history, right?
Yeah, the band. I mean, you know, it's the core members have stayed the same.
Roddy and Borden were the guys, yeah, that were the core.
But yeah, it is when you think, and yeah, when I think of it like that, and then you're saying about when he came out that it all changed. It's quite astounding that, in a way, when you think that you to have all those changes, and yet the band has, you know, there's a clear line from this album which you're re-releasing.
Exactly, you can hear us in that.
Yeah,
that first record, you can. That's the cool thing, but it is really different. Yeah. And I mean, it's like back to the cooking analogy. I mean, really, sometimes just a little bit of vinegar and it takes the food in a completely different direction.
Yeah.
And it's just one little ingredient. And so bands, like when you have something, it's very vulnerable to change, actually. And you have this really delicate balance that looks very natural because you're consuming the final product. But actually, it's very sensitive, and a changing of one little part changes the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's a very, I don't say precious, that's a bad word to use, but it's fragile.
And I mean, did you feel that each time, you know, somebody else would come in and somebody would leave, how tricky were those transitions? I think like the transition between Chuck and Patton was the most obvious one from an outside perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That's initially what a lot of people will lock onto, that especially if they're not musicians,
right?
You know, but it seemed like such a like a clean, it sounds weird, like a clean transition. Do you know what I mean? It didn't feel like clunky and stuff. I mean, everyone right. was finding their feet.
Well, even though he was a lot younger than us, really.
Yeah, exactly.
And at the beginning, I remember we first came here with Patton, and the reviewers were calling us like, it was like the new Coke to the old Coke.
Yeah.
Like they got the shiny new Coke, you know? And so we had a little bit of that. But yeah, I mean, probably because, I mean, if I would have consciously wanted the next singer, I don't know if Patton was where I would have gone.
Hmm.
If I was saying, we need to get a singer who can do this, like, we need a guy who's going to get us to sell a million records, you know? Like,
yeah.
I mean, maybe I would have, maybe I wouldn't have, because he was a real kid then. He's grown a lot since he first joined us and kind of come to his own. And he wasn't there when we first got together. And the point was that it just felt right. Like he kind of felt what we were doing, and he put himself in a way that we all fit together. And it was one of these gut things that is like, we can continue because the feeling of what we were doing is still there.
Yeah.
And it's not the conscious thing that you can make happen by just picking this over here and adding it to that.
Mm.
You just kind of have to know, is it taste good or it doesn't taste good, and it tasted good.
Yeah. To see how he changed from that initial, you know, like, it must have been so, like, it's so weird looking back on it now. Like, you know, when he first joined the band and the sudden kind of the whole MTV vibe of everybody jumping on and going, oh, this is going to be this. And yet at the same time, you know, then people became aware of Bungle that necessarily wouldn't have heard that before.
That's true.
And you know, that band's fucking bananas. Great. But I mean, he was doing things like, I remember seeing shows where he would just do these things that were so obnoxious.
Oh yeah.
And but that was beautiful to see, because it seemed so jarring, you know, like this weird kind of fucking Gigi Allen style.
Yeah,
it's one of the beautiful things, isn't it? And yeah. Anyway,
it's funny, you know. I mean, he was talking about like he was getting injured with us back before we split up, like in the '90s, and he was getting like, over the shit, you know, like, you know, having a stage dive and do all this stuff, this stupid shit I do. It's just, you know, it's because, you know, I hate it. It hurts, you know. And so he did, you know, 15 years where he, besides Mr. Bungle stuff, where it was different. It was a little more cerebral and musical in a different way. And when he came back to playing with us again after Brixton, like, he started doing the stage dives and stuff again. It's like, we're not telling him to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And he was like, he was hurting himself. He's older, you know? And he's like, I'm trying to figure out what it is being in this band that makes me do this. But it was very natural. He did a lot of really obnoxious things, but he was being compelled to do it.
Yeah.
Something about the music and how we were as people, that's kind of his, he found his place and that's how he found it. And it's really strange, but it is what it is. That's what it is. This combination of people does that to him, I guess.
Amazing. Yeah. All right.
Cool.
Well, I think that's a good point.
All right.
Thanks, man.
All right, man.
Appreciate that.
Thank you for listening to Swim Podcast Episode 11. Cheers to Bill Gould for being amazing and also a total inspiration and making me want to play bass in the first place. As I said, their debut album is getting reissued on his label, Cool Arrow. It comes out August 19th. There's new mixes, there's demos, there's live recordings, all sorts, as we discussed, obviously. You can follow Faith No More on Twitter and Instagram on @FaithNoMore. It's @CoolArrowRec for the label as well. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram @DanielPCarter. I've started trying to do like these little videos that shows the sort of progress as I'm painting some of these portraits that are the cover images for the podcast, but I always get to a certain point and then have to concentrate and kind of lose out on doing it. But anyway, there's a bit there anyway. You can have a look on my Instagram. If you're enjoying the podcast, remember, if you've missed any, don't forget that the old episodes are still online. There's great stuff with Maynard James Keenan, Chino Moreno, Corey Taylor, John Baisley, Jacob Bannon, Scott Ian, Ollie Sykes, Sam Carter, etc., etc. They're all pretty amazing, I think. I'm stoked with all of them. I won't lie, I'm pretty happy with how the guests are panning out. Which brings us to the next episode of Swim, which is actually going to be a two-part magical extravaganza with Mr. Alan Moore. That was an amazing thing. I went up to Northampton and we hung out at the Lodge Studios. Thank you to those dudes as well. You can hear that on the next episode. It's going to be in two parts, as I said. Once again, thanks to Sonos UK and letting us use Sonos Studios. Please leave a review on iTunes. 5 stars would be much appreciated. Hope you enjoy it. Spread the word.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Spread the love. Peace.